Thank you very much, Dylan. And Dylan spent many years in the Center for Earth and Planetary Physics at Harvard also, as I did. It was a fun place, but we all escaped and came to better places. So you got Dylan here, and I went to California eventually. I'm going to talk about issues of how we understand how large-scale features and how systems couple when we look at the composition of the atmosphere. It's going to be based on a mixture of sort of a bit of mathematics and a bit of sort of fundamental chemistry, and I hope that it's going to work for this wide audience. This picture, which doesn't come out too well, is from my backyard one morning this January. That's Mount Wilson, 60 miles away to the north at sunrise. It's not bad. It gets brighter the day, but LA's not always like this, but on some days you can see 75 miles across the basin. It's quite amazing. We'll talk several things. One about atmospheric chemistry, the issue of time scales, linearization, chemical modes, what they mean, introduce you to them. We'll look at stratospheric ozone chemistry, as was done by Sidney Chapman, 1930s, to understand what we mean by out oxygen. And we'll actually, instead of trying to magically declare out oxygen and come up with it, we'll actually do a very simple formal definition, which will define it very simply, which our community had not done for about 60 years. We'll look at tropospheric ozone, how it affects climate chemistry, how feedbacks work. We'll take a look at integrating environmental impacts as to how do you come up with an integrative quantity. Knowing the behavior and everything has odd time dependences and everything kicks something else, how do you actually do an integrated environmental impact when you start kicking the bottom of a chair and then everything happens, things fall off and whatever, you should be able to evaluate it. We'll look at some new 3D work we've done on these chemical modes. It's fairly recent. And finally, we'll sort of look, I mean, I won't look too hard, but the question really, I can't answer it, is does this really work in the real world? This is a somewhat idealistic case of models. So, first of all, there's several myth busters. This is more for the atmospheric chemistry audience, and since you're a physicist here, there's no problem. You don't have these myths, okay? So, one thing is people in chemistry always say, oh, atmospheric chemistry is so complicated. Oh, God, it's highly nonlinear. We have all these things, we unexpectedly large response to perturbations and everything else. My answer is hogwash. Yes, chemistry is nonlinear because X reacts with Y. That's a quadratic. It's a second order term, okay? Therefore, it's nonlinear. However, that said, most of the chemistry we deal with in the real world and most everything we see is highly linearizable. And all you do is put in the current situation, you linearize it, and it's a linear system. And that's what we've been finding out so far. There are cases where it may not be. They may be interesting. But most of the world, chemistry is not a highly nonlinear system. No. Hogwash. Stay-state lifetime of a gas. It's a magic name. Unless you've been living in assessments long enough, everybody has the stay-state lifetime of the gas is this. This is a fundamental property. We put in nitrous oxide. It has a lifetime of 120 years, so we know how long it lasts in E-folds. And what people mistakenly think that this is a property of the gas itself, and instead, no, it's actually a property of the atmosphere, which is important, but it's also a property of where you put it in. So it's not a property of the gas itself. And we'll look at things that are properties of the gas itself in the atmosphere. That is the mode, not the lifetimes. Finally, short-lived gases impact the climate for only a short time. We've gotten around that one. It took a while. I was a believer in that one until recently, until maybe 8 years ago, 10 years ago. The concept that short-lived gases would NOx would have a limited impact on climate merely because it only lived in the atmosphere for about a week. And I was actually one to sort of beat on Dick Derwent in 1992 and said, this can't be serious, can you? Okay. So that's my own myth that I failed on that one. Finally, there are other tougher myths that are hard to break, okay? This is the beware of the Cheney dog, okay? And so there's some myths we just aren't going to get around to breaking at all. This is the one I won't deal with, so you can have fun with those. Okay, we'll skip myth four. First of all, so what are we talking about? We're talking about a system which we sort of try to do budgets and numbers and pull out numbers from. So if you look at sort of chemistry, what do we have? We have L, big L, we'll call the integrated loss of a trace gas, kilograms in a year. We integrate the budget of methane over many different places and times in the atmosphere, nitrous oxide in the stratosphere. We have these gases come up. The chemistry destroys them. We have a total loss rate. We then have a burden. Total global burden is you just integrate what's out there. This is in the atmosphere. It's in the ocean. It could be in a biogeochemical system. And then you divide one by the other, and you get something that has units of time. Okay? If you divide kilograms by kilograms per year, you end up with years. This sounds very good. At least you got your units right. Okay? Real problem, okay? At least you have your units right. And the problem is then everybody thinks this is the lifetime and the E-fold and everything happens on this time scale. And the answer is all you've done is take two things which are totally different and have the right units and produce something and have time. So we'll look at does this really represent anything to do with the time scales? Finally, you can often have a sort of a source, which we'll call S. And when, just as a concept notation, steady state means when your source equals your loss, that is what you put in equals what you take out. You're not in equilibrium because it's not detailed balance. There's no detailed balance. You're always forcing the system. But you're forcing it into a steady state by pumping so much in the box, and then so much gets eaten up by chemistry or falls out through diffusive holes. So it's not in equilibrium at all, but it is actually quite a steady state that is repeatable. And you can think of steady states being repeatable during the day. That is, every 24 hours repeats, every year repeats, annual cycles. You know, there are cycles in the system, but you can still think of it as being in steady state. And that's viewed as magic by many people, that steady state has some magic to it. And so there's a steady state lifetime, which is then again defined the usual way. The problem is this sort of definition is useful. It actually will show it has some integrative properties, but it doesn't really describe the temporal behavior of the system. This time scale that we calculate here has very little to do with the temporal behavior of the system when you kick it. And that's something important to realize, which most of my colleagues, some of my colleagues have not most do now. I've beaten on them enough. And the other is, it's not really a general property. Steady state lifetime is not a property of the of anything that's going on. Why? Because it really depends on where you put the source in. And we'll look at that one. Steady state depends on, if I emit in some place and I destroy somewhere else, the steady state burden depends upon where I'm emitting or where I'm putting the stuff in. It's not a property of the atmosphere or anything that's natural. So this concept of steady state lifetime depends on how I force the system. Then there will be some steady state unit that has times. Okay, so what do I work with? Solving basically what I call the continuity equation gives me the relationship of how some species V is changing. V is the location X, Y, Z. N is a chemical species. These are all my variables. I have chemistry, I have transport, I have radiation. I can put this in a biogeochemical system if I want with species. Basically, I'm doing a continuity equation for all my variables. And so I have different types of operators. They come out, and I'm trying to solve this equation one way or the other. I can solve it analytically or whatever, but right now we'll just leave it as a generic form. The generic form then looks something like this, that the rate of change, V, of these species everywhere is basically some operator A that acts on the species. So combination of all my species everywhere at this time tells me how they're changing everywhere else. Why? Nearest neighbors are transport. Okay, two species next to each other can exchange if they're ozone by transport. However, transport doesn't turn ozone into nitrous oxide. Okay, chemistry can change species. Okay, we're not doing nuclear work here. So radiation can trap, one species can block radiation from another, okay? So all of these can impact effectively the solution. I need to know them all, and that's what we do. When we do massive 3D models or make messes out of them, this is what we do. Basically, we solve the set of equations. Now, what we want to look at is we want to basically go through and sort of look at the continuity equation and what happens to a perturbation. And this is sort of the last of the major derivations. We'll do a few others, but if we look at the rate of change of a perturbation to the system, we can then expand this very simple Taylor series. We do a first order Taylor series expansion, the second order series. This is a physics colloquium, all set. Okay. Second order Taylor series, we ignore the del V squared. And we end up with basically a linearized system. This is all we're talking about, is a simple linearized eigenvalue type system. The Jacobian is J, and that's basically the linearized chemical system. Now, the advantage of this is then it tells us how perturbations behave. Most of the time, we do not. Seriously, if you're looking at environmental issues or whatever, you're not worried about how the atmosphere behaves as a whole from absolutely fundamental. You're always doing perturbations of the atmosphere. That's what we're doing. Our climate change is a perturbation to an existing atmosphere. It's not suddenly starting from ground zero. So this is dealing with perturbations around some base state. Okay. Then you recognize that the eigenvalues, they're eigenvalues, and so the Jacobian matrix can be decomposed into its eigenvectors and eigenvalues, and then you can end up with a very simple thing that every perturbation has a nice E-fold or E-growth, okay? The eigenvalue has a solution. That pattern is a pattern. Your eigenvectors are patterns. They're the modes, the patterns of behavior. They have time constants. You can have time constants that are positive or negative. Positive would grow, negative decay. You can have complex. They're clocks. There's various chemical clocks you can build that actually have oscillators in them, okay, to the system. And so effectively, you're linearizing the system, and you can basically express anything as a relative species across all space and time. You can say, I've got some perturbation, I can map it onto certain patterns. Those patterns have exact E-fold behaviors. And so then we can combine, let's see if we do this one, and we end up saying any perturbation can be written as the sum of the eigenvector patterns and their own time scale. Now, as I said, most of all the things I've come across, I've been looking for ones where the lambdas are positive. I haven't found one that's positive. That's really nice. That's unstable systems. If you work in dynamics, you can have explosive dynamics and fluid mechanics where the system suddenly becomes unpredictable That's where you have positive eigenvalues, things, small perturbations grow. On chemistry, I've yet to find one in a large scale in the atmosphere. Been looking for them, can't find them. The other one would be sort of complex, would be nice. Chemical clocks, haven't found them either. So mostly everything I've found in chemistry is pretty boring. All the lambdas are negative. It's pretty boring. All the perturbations decay. Alas. Again, we do this sum in stable systems. We're going to find lifetimes. Our time scales are 1 over lambda. They're the time scales of the E-fold, so that's the real time scales of the system. That says how the system responds in different time scales are your eigenvalues, okay? And then we have sort of chemical modes. Now, the idea is any perturbation will be decomposed into these modes, and we'll look at some examples of how you kick the atmosphere. Your kick can be decomposed into these different patterns with the different time scales. And actually, it's very neat because it gives you a closed form solution. If you know what they are, you can say, oh, this perturbation does this, 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 and this. So it's fairly neat if you can get it to work. And the other one that's unusual is because most of the chemical matrices are not, they're not, physics matrices are often symmetric. Symmetric matrices have nice, more orthogonal properties. Chemistry matrices are real asymmetric. Almost all these matrices you're dealing with transport in chemistry are real asymmetric matrices. That means that they are linearly independent, but they're not orthogonal. That means that a perturbation to any species will excite almost every other species in every other mode, okay? It means that generally if I kick one species, almost all the modes will be excited to a different amplitude, okay? Which is interesting because that says, you know, some counterintuitive things happen, that is you can change one species and all of a sudden something else happens 10 years later. This is the original Sidney Chapman mechanism for ozone chemistry. I put in numbers that are applicable to 42 kilometers, not that different from what he did in 1930, okay? And the system is fairly simple. Molecular oxygen is photolyzed around 200 nanometers or less into basically two oxygens. The two oxygens can recombine with molecular oxygen to get you ozone. And then the ozone gets photolyzed back into atomic oxygen. And occasionally, reaction 4, atomic oxygen and ozone recombine, closing the system and making O2 back again. And so the Chapman mechanism was recognized that the first reaction creates ozone. The second two recycle and circulate it, not changing it. And the fourth one closes the system down. And so that's what determines the sort of steady state balance. This goes back to 1930 when Sidney put the sort of first sort of photochemical model of the atmosphere that I know of existing. Okay. Now, I put in numbers that are applicable. Okay. And these are the rate equations. So I have the rate of change that's basically all those reactions, plus 1, minus 1. You can see the different rates. I plugged in numbers that are applicable for 42 kilometers. And I have a 3x3 system. I have a rate of change of ozone, atomic oxygen, and then molecular oxygen. So I have three equations I'm solving for. Basically, O3 is changing, O2 is changing, and O is changing. So it's very simple. This is really trivial. This is the 3x3 Jacobian. It's the partial derivative of that set of equations. This is the Jacobian matrix. It's literally the partial of each row with the partial of each independent variable. So I have a 3x3 linearized system. So this is my totally linearized system with the numbers, the variables plugged in. So now I have a 3x3 system. And I can actually solve that for what is the true behavior system. Now, what have scientists been doing since Sidney Chapman and since actually until recently? I don't think I've ever bothered publishing this example, so it's an interesting case. Everybody tries to understand the time scale of ozone, and everybody's always worried. In the 70s, we're going to know what's the time scale for ozone to change in the stratosphere. So I've given you 5 different time scales. And these are all time scales by dividing a rate into an abundance. It's the same way we get time scales in chemistry. You divide a burden by a rate, and you get a time scale. Okay. I've got at least 5 time scales. You can come up with more, and these are the obvious ones. If I take, how long does it take to photolyze all of the atomic oxygen, molecular oxygen at 42 kilometers is 176 years. Okay, that's how long it takes to actually photolyze oxygen at 42 kilometers, about 176 years. How long does it take to photolyze ozone in sunlight? 12 minutes. How long does it take for oxygen to react with molecular oxygen, go back again? Very fast, 1 second, 1.5 seconds. And then Chapman and others came up with this term of odd oxygen, which combined ozone and atomic oxygen together and gave you this term called odd oxygen. And everybody had very funny thing, drug boxes around boundaries and rates and whatever. There's a lot of work done on this thing. And they'd come up with 1.5 days. And finally, there's total O. The total amount of O does not change in this system because I have no sink for the nucleus of oxygen. So there's basically an infinity time constant, which literally says I'm not losing any O, O2, or O3 out of the system. I'm just circulating more. So I got you 5 time constants. Now, how many are there in the system? 3, right? 3 variables, 3 time constants. Okay, which are the right ones? Okay, so people in the 70s and 80s argued over this. I'm sorry, they really argued over this. What's the right time constant to use? What's, you know, I mean, it was amazing when you think about it that we were that primitive that there were no physicists in our organization who really understood what to do. I mean, I'm sorry, it really was silly when you think about it. So all you do is you solve the 3x3 Jacobian, you get three time constants, okay? One is zero, that's infinite. That's the, you know, that's because oxygen is not changing. One is 1.4 seconds. That's a lesson I've learned. The largest diagonal term, which is the shortest time constant, is the one that hardly ever changes in these systems because it is the largest diagonally dominant term, and 1.4 seconds is hard to change. That's a real time constant of the system. And the third one is 0.74 days. It's actually half of the odd oxygen time constant because the chemistry, the equations weren't done right, okay? That is, there is no 12-minute time constant. There is no 176-year time constant. So whenever I perturb this system, you don't see 12 minutes in any timescale perturbation whatsoever, okay? I mean, this is important. There really are only three, and these are what they are. And it gets around this whole argument, what really is odd oxygen? And if you look at the sort of the eigenvectors, they sort of look like odd oxygen, sort of the various mix of species. And so basically, it gives you a very simple understanding of a system that we really spent a decade squabbling over time constants. And when I think about what we did in the 70s to do with stratospheric ozone arguments, it was pretty funny. So I would say that being simple-minded and carrying out a linearization system gives you the quick answers you need without worrying about where you draw the boxes. It also tells you the real time constant and how the system responds. So one of the next things of major intrigue was methane. Methane's an interesting gas. There's a lot of chemistry going on with methane. This is one of the earliest papers that pointed out some of the problems by Ivar Isaksson, Øystein Hoff, that when they increased methane abundances, and what happens was that methane went up more than they increased the methane flux, because methane influenced OH, hydroxyl radical, which was its own loss. Methane, therefore, went up. OH went down. The sink for methane went down, so methane went up higher. And so they came up with this issue that a 2.4-fold increase in methane abundances need only a 1.87-fold increase in the emissions. So they noticed this feedback factor in steady state. And they were running two-dimensional models out to steady state. That was interesting. It got buried. Nobody paid too much attention to it. 87, we weren't too much interested in methane in terms of climate at that point, but climate was just getting interesting. The other one in 1993, which got me going on this topic at all, was Don Fisher presented at an alternative fluorocarbon symposium out of the blue in 1993 in Boulder. He presented a result from his model that seemed to make no sense. He had a two-dimensional model, full atmospheric chemistry and running things, but in 2D. And he put in a perturbation of methane, okay? And when he put the perturbation of methane in, he watched it decay. And he had a lifetime of methane that was 8 years in the model. And that the lifetime was the steady state lifetime, the burden divided by the budget. So he said, okay, it should decay in 12 years. I put in this perturbation, and it decayed in, it should decay in 8 years, and it decayed in 12 years. And everybody, he's up there going, he said, I have no idea what this is. It makes no sense. So he said, oh, it's all these nonlinear effects. You know, you just put too big a perturbation, it's nonlinear. He said, no, you understand, I cut the perturbation by a factor of 100, and it still decayed in 12 years. It had nothing to do with the size of the perturbation. And people kept saying, no, it's all nonlinear. You know, you really don't understand what's going on. Poor Don. He went back to doing Kevlar tires because he worked for DuPont. He was one of the people who was doing the ozone work for DuPont, and they moved people every 10 years in mathematical modeling, so he went back to doing Kevlar tires. It was his next assignment. We never saw him again in environmental science. It was good. Anyhow, so this inspired, I talked with Doc Seawer, and this inspired me to go after, you know, what's happening, okay? And so everybody thought this was crazy nonlinear chemistry, didn't get very far. And so what I decided to do at the time that year was to go analyze the system and linearize it. So I created a simple model that had methane, CO, and OH, and it was a three-chemical system. It was like Chapman chemistry, okay? And it involved the basic reactions in chemistry where there were sources of methane, sources. So we have, there's methane makes carbon monoxide reacts with OH, methane reacts with OH, and there's a source of OH from sunlight, which we kept fixed. And it's very simple reactions. We just put in what would be a very simple box model of the troposphere, nothing near what Dylan does now, but, you know, easy going, okay? And we put in the sources and sinks to match the atmosphere. So I made a one-box model of the atmosphere. And if you put in the right sources, then everything matches right. You get the right amount of methane, 1,700 parts per billion, and so on. So you can produce a fairly simple model of what would be the box troposphere. So then you go back and you say, OK, let's linearize this. So this is the Jacobian of the system. It's the partials of each of the rows of each of the continuity equations with each of the independent degrees of freedom. Okay, you put in the numbers there. Those are the numbers for the steady state. They're in units of per year. All those are per year. So the first column is the methane, the second is the CO1 primarily, and the last is the OH, that's why it's at different scales. And you can see this matrix is interesting because it's not upper or lower triangular. It's got terms on both sides. which is important because that's what does the coupling, okay? And so the diagonal elements, if you pull the diagonal elements on, these are the time constants that Don Fisher would have reported as the lifetime. Those diagonal elements, one over them, is effectively what everybody thinks of as the lifetime, the steady state lifetime of these gases. So the diagonal elements are 9.6 years for methane, a little under a quarter year for CO, and you know, half a second for OH. So these would be the classic lifetimes that the chemists would have reported. So then you go through and you say, okay, now let's solve the whole system. And what happens is you end up with something quite different. You end up with 13.6 years instead of 9.6, because that's the eigenvalue of that long time constant. You end up with 0.28 instead of 0.24, because all the feedbacks in the chemistry, which are recognized as linear, that is, they're not nonlinear effects. And you end up with these funny little eigenvectors I tried to plot on the right in terms of bar charts. So the first one in blue is the methane one, has a little bit of CO. The second one is the sort of primarily a CO one, which has a negative methane, a positive CO, and so on. But what's interesting is that if you then look at the bottom part, what happens if you perturb methane? If you perturb methane with one unit, you end up with a perturbation that has 99.5% decaying with 13.6 years, but half a percent decaying with like a quarter year, and so on. And so by perturbing methane, the longest lived gas, I dump one unit in, I end up with this whole mix here of three different time constants for methane, for CO, and whatever. You'll notice CO has zero perturbation, plus 0.035, minus 0.035. I didn't perturb CO. So at time zero, there can be, CO has to be zero change. But what happens is then the methane decays away, and suddenly this new thing appears, and you have a perturbation that looks like both methane and CO together. This is not too astounding. It's interesting for methane. The more astounding part was the next one. What happens if you perturb CO? CO is a short-lived gas. Well, if you perturb CO as a short-lived gas, you get this pattern that is mostly CO, but then you suddenly end up with this other pattern that says, I now perturb methane. Okay, and I perturb methane by interacting through the chemistry, and it comes out automatically out of the equations. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to invent it. You don't have to draw boxes around things. It just comes out automatically out of the system. So it's an amazingly useful analytic tool for these messier environmental complex or biogeochemical systems we work with. It tells you what the coupling is, and now says if I kick a short-lived gas, it explains automatically why I get the methane perturbed. You note the methane has zero perturbation at time zero. The two terms cancel. But as time wears on, after a month, several months, suddenly the methane perturbation appears. Okay. And now this comes out of a toy model, and if you do a real model, you get the same thing. It's the off-diagonal models in that Jacobian we saw, the terms that are sort of keep it from being an upper or lower triangular matrix that make this interesting. Okay, they drive it. And I had the worst trouble. I brought these results to 1995-96 to an IPCC meeting and said we have to change the effective lifetime of methane perturbations by 40% because we're doing the wrong value on calculating the climate impacts. And I got attacked by a Nobel laureate and a National Medal of Science person from the US who dragged me off and said, this is patently wrong. And you cannot do this. It makes no sense. We don't understand it. It makes no sense. Well, I said, I'm sorry that you don't understand it, but it does make sense. So finally, I came up with this toy thing, which then finally said, oh, okay. So one of the ways to think about it is, okay, you don't accept the mathematics. You know that the mathematics isn't going to lie to you on this, but you don't accept it. So what you do is you say, okay, here's my baseline of methane. It's sitting at 1750. Production and loss are balancing each other. Suddenly add a little bit. What happens is the little bit, which is colored red, the methane is colored red, decays away with 8 years. But what it does is it induces a pulse in the baseline, which then changes the whole decay time of the system. So if you want to think about what you're doing by putting the pulse in, methane molecules you colored are decaying away in 8 years. But they perturb the system. And you can't tell the difference. You can't color methane molecules. We can't do that, okay? So what we could, if we put in a massive load of C13 methane, we might be able to tell the difference, but it's a little bit obscure. So effectively, what you've done is perturb the background system. So finally, I got through to the brighter minds, okay? But this is one way of understanding the system, which I'm serious. The chemists would not accept the mathematical viewpoint. They just felt this was totally wrong. But this one worked, okay? So then my postdoc, Oliver Wilde, then went off to Japan in the middle of all this, and then he finished doing the 3D modeling because Japan had better computers than we did in Irvine, certainly. This was Frontier Research System, Global Change at Yokohama. They had the big ones then. And so he managed to get the 3D model running for long times, and he would then do full 3D chemistry, and this is one location from a 3D model whereby you have a pulse of methane going up, and then you watch what happens over the succeeding years. So this is 10 years, And this is one location, so it's bouncing around. So you're seeing methane, carbon monoxide, ozone, and even NOx in one location. And what you're seeing is because the meteorology recycles annually, it's an annually recycling sort of transportation pattern. It's in 3D, it changes every few hours, okay? This is a huge 3D model, but you're seeing a regular repeating mode cycle even with running a full up 3D model, which has 10 to the 8 degrees of freedom. So this model has 10 to the 8 eigenmodes and 10 to the 8 timescales. But the long-lived one, this methane, is still the longest-lived mode in this chemical model, and it still has this long, nice decay time, and the decay time is 1.4 times the, quote, steady-state lifetime. It's about that number that's in the feedbacks. So you can show that happens both in the 3D model, and we suspect, therefore, this is probably good, maybe not a representation of the world, but justifiable. These are the flying carpet patterns that Dylan dug up, they put on the poster to interest you. These are effectively, if we look at the methane, 100 part per billion perturbation of methane in the 3D model has fluctuations of 2 or 3 parts per billion over the seasonality, and that's the flying carpet is the seasonality of the perturbation. It induces then 1 to 3 ppb of CO absolute that's out of phase with the methane. That's sort of the cycle of CO that comes from this perturbation. And then we also get a perturbation of about 0.5 ppb of ozone, but in a very different pattern. It's responding to the photochemistry and NOx and everything else. So we're seeing basically perturbations on down the chain, all of which are, this is one mode, this is the one long-lived mode in the atmosphere in our 3D model. And when we change the circulation, the chemistry, it doesn't change that much. Most of tropospheric chemistry is fairly, I would say, squishy. You know, sort of, yeah. So what happened, of course, then there are embarrassing parts. Here's the 1992 report. The first climate change was intermediate climate change. The first one was 1990. This is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 92. And we, conclusions were that CO NOx could not really be useful and that the not possible to quantify the indirect global warming potentials, that what CO would do to long-lived gases. There was a comment, and I was partly the complainer on this one, so it's my own fault. Mistaken belief that NOx and CO would be short-lived. Okay, we all make mistakes. In 95, after doing this and what Oliver did and the basic background between Isaacson and Hove and the paper I wrote on sort of the box model, we managed to get in spite of the arguments against in the 95 climate assessment, that there was this fundamental feedback. Methane went up, OH went down, methane went up further. CO went up, OH went down, methane went up. These were the feedbacks that we got into the 1995 report and then 2001 report. Okay. One of the biggest issues that happened in 2001 was it clearly established that the methane was a factor of 1.4 larger. This is probably the largest shift in any of the climate assessments that I know of, except for maybe black carbon and the aerosol issues. For importance, it basically made methane 40% more important as a climate gas instantly. Okay. CO was recognized. CO is not really a greenhouse gas, but again, through perturbing methane it was. So it wasn't just feedback on itself. Okay. And then 2007, the latest one, we get this next one again that we're now looking at. Estimates give a mean value for the indirect GWP for CO, so we're propagating it. And so effectively, the science has already said this. There is no policy that's going to do this. There's enough trouble negotiating the 6 Kyoto gases. I just talked to some people. We had a discussion about what's happened post-Kyoto from the State Department point of view, our State Department. And the issue is there's just no way they're going to deal with these other gases. They can't get CO under. They do not want to be confused with other. I mean, they don't mind it, but they don't see this being an issue. And the question is, it's not too much of an issue, but, you know. The NOx one became interesting because NOx is it's the big gas. Okay, it makes ozone in the cities. It's one of our major smog polluting agents. It's a smog polluting agent globally. Okay, and we're looking at NOx from aircraft. This is one of the big assessments for aviation was done in 1999. Okay, and so this issue about NOx as an indirect greenhouse gas was proposed by Shine and Derwent in 1990. Rejected as too far and then put back in 1992. And so in 2007, we're already now generating the fact that NOx does make ozone, and there are already both CO and NOx for indirect GWPs. So I'm going to skip through this one. Self-feedback. I'm going back. No wonder I've seen this before. This gets me worried. That's it. Okay. Thank you. Wrong buttons. So one of the things that NOx does that's very intriguing is it pushes ozone up for a short time period and pushes methane down. The ozone goes up for the time period of the NOx emissions. Within a few weeks, it's gone. And so for 1 year of NOx emissions, you see ozone up for 1 year. When you reduce the NOx emissions, ozone drops. So that's short-lived. But what NOx does also is then it depletes methane because it makes hydroxyl radical, enhances the chemistry, so methane drops. So what you end up with is the NOx goes up, the ozone goes up for a year or so, and then the methane drops for 15 years. And so you have two different time scales, and they both cancel radiatively. One's warming, the other's cooling. And so this gets one of the key issues about how to deal with aviation NOx, pollution NOx, transport NOx, and it's one of the EU's major projects that just got completed called Quantify. And so we have this trouble. This is my favorite bar chart that's hard to figure out, but not bar chart. The line down the middle is neutral climate. And if you're down that line, you have either cooling from the long-lived ozone. So this is cooling because you've reduced methane. And then this is warming because you've increased tropospheric ozone. The cooling occurs on a time scale of 20 years. The warming cools on a time scale of 1 to 2 years. But integrating them out, you find that most emissions of NOx fall along a zero line, which makes the pluses and minuses very hard. And so what you see is a range of different emissions that go from Northern Europe to lightning NOx and aircraft. One of the lessons on this is fundamental to tropospheric chemistry is that there's nothing like the free troposphere in the tropics to count. Northern European emissions are the little red, green dot way up there. These are all the same amount of emissions. It really is hard for Northern European emissions to make any impact on global tropospheric chemistry. I'm sorry. There's just not enough sunlight. There's not enough action. The stuff gets dumped. And as you start moving down, you go from Europe, North America, East Asia, finally the tropics, and then you put aircraft and you dump the stuff in the upper troposphere and boom. So the further you get away from the ground, the bigger the impact, but they're still almost neutral. Last report started giving indirect GWPs for these gases, which is interesting, okay. Now, one of the things about that's sort of intriguing is you'd like to know how to build, how you interpret the steady state lifetime and how you integrate a response. Because one of the things is you'd like to say, I put this amount in, what happens? It took a while, something got in the stratosphere, it depleted ozone, then the ozone went down. You'd like to say, what's the integrated effect? Because, you know, if you integrate a 3D model or any model, you get some sort of time-dependent response. Things happen, go up, go down, decay away eventually, and you end up with sort of, you want the area under that curve. So one of the goals is to say, if you want to integrate the environmental impact, which is the area under whatever you want, was ozone depletion, UV flux, you can do any derivative products. You'd like to say, how do I integrate this? So one of the things we do is we try to define how you would define a steady state. So we put in these modes. You basically can do them analytically. You excite certain modes. They decay away. You know the closing. You can integrate them. And if you integrate, you know, what would be the, here's your steady state thing. You can integrate what steady state is. Steady state is the accumulation of emissions from past history. So that's, sorry, in the same notation, that's the sum of different species, so it's the different time scales from the modes, the different amplitudes of the modes, and that's what happens if I emit something in steady state, and that's my steady state sort of time scales. And so I can define the steady state lifetime in terms of the modes. So don't worry about it, but the equation down below says this is a way I can define it. So that by itself was not very interesting, okay? But now the question is, suppose I want to know what a pulse does, and I want to integrate something down the chain. If I actually put a pulse of material in, I can then integrate that effect. I can then divide it up into three terms. And the three terms I divide it up to basically are the steady state pattern, the steady state lifetime, okay, and then another one by just the amount in the pulse to the amount in steady state. So it turns out when I do a perturbation, it matters where I emit the stuff. I have to know where I'm emitting material in the atmosphere to determine the perturbation. So if I emit in steady state, I'd build up a steady state pattern from that emission. Then I can say, okay, here's my pattern, here's the material. And it turns out that the steady state lifetime is actually the integral of all the modes. So the steady state lifetime has some magic in it. It works for a given emission pattern, and it actually tells you what the integral of all the things that happened following that, whatever you pumped into it. So let me see if I can give you one example. This is bromine. So this is a study did long ago on bromine released by methyl bromide. This is a whole bunch of the decay terms. This is what happens to bromine at 20 kilometers. And I just wrote out a whole bunch of little e-folds and the coefficients because what it looks like is the following. What it looks like is the red curve. The red curve is, in a reasonable model, if I put methyl bromide in the surface, it takes a while for methyl bromide to mix with the troposphere. Then it has to get in the lower stratosphere. Then it has to decay by OH and photolysis. It has to release the bromine at 20 kilometers, and then eventually it all washes out because the stratosphere turns over and whatever. So I get that red curve, okay? So the red curve is, if you want to say, is effectively ozone depletion due to bromine. That is, if I emit bromine, the ozone depletion is going to peak a couple of years afterwards. It's going to build up and sort of have a soft peak. And what everybody does for the assessments, WMO included, is the curve on the left, the blue one. And if they get really smart, they say, oh, it takes 2 years to mix in the stratosphere, so they take the dash curve and they move the curve over 2 years. Okay. This is one of the false arguments that was given long ago that methyl bromide is a quick fix to the ozone depletion problem. Depends on what you mean by quick. Okay. It's quick compared to chlorofluorocarbons, which are 50 to 100 years, but it's not quick compared to the lifetime of methyl bromide. Methyl bromide has a, quote, lifetime in this model of about 1 to 2 years. Okay. And you can see that the time scale of the perturbation is not over 1 to 2 years. It's over 5 to 10. Why? Because there are different time scales in the system. But the area under those curves is identical. And that, as I said, you can actually prove by the previous derivations that the area you get by assuming the steady state lifetime is an exact E-fold, which is the blue curve, turns out to have exactly the same area as what happens under a realistic rise, fall, different time scales. And so actually, after being dissing the steady state lifetime, it actually has very useful things, as long as you recognize what it's good for. Okay, it's an integrated quantity. It measures the integral of the environmental impact of a gas from those emissions. But it does not describe the time scale of the behavior. That's the key point. So anyhow, sorry, didn't know that one. But it surprised me when the area was identical under them. It forced me to go back and figure out why. A nitrous oxide is a fun greenhouse gas. Okay. Has a bunch of systems. This is the N2O system in the stratosphere. It reacts with photolysis, it reacts with single D, it generates NO. The NO attacks ozone in the stratosphere. So we have nitrous oxide making NO and NO2. They attack ozone in the stratosphere and come out. And so you end up with a system that also gets destroyed in the upper troposphere. These are the chemical reactions. Skip that. So this is my linearized matrix for the N2O nitrous oxide system, whereby it's sort of a fun one because what you have is you have a 1D diffusion models. I've done that one. So this is a linearized matrix. Each one of those is a little block, 3x3 for the chemistry. Okay. This includes T is transport, P is chemistry, B is boundary conditions. And the little zeros are not really zero. They're actually radiation coupling because ozone at different levels controls the photolysis of N2O. Therefore, the whole system is a huge matrix. And so what I did was put together a simple one-box diffusion model, not one box, a 1D diffusion model, and try and solve the system for N2O and ozone. And so what I got were this was the steady state abundance, the steady state lifetime was 127 years. Then we put in the perturbations, and we found that the time scale of a perturbation dropped from 127 years to a various weird pattern that actually decayed in 110 years. And so once again, looking at chemical feedbacks, one way to look at it is nitrous oxide goes up and destroys ozone. Destroying ozone actually makes the ultraviolet more intense and destroys the nitrous oxide faster. So what you find out is a perturbation N2O does not decay with a steady state lifetime, 127 years, but decays with about 110 years. And since then, we've played with it and shown similar things. So it actually shortens the perturbation time. This one is a quick table. And the only thing that's intriguing on this one is understanding it matters where you put it. So in each one of these columns, we put 1,000 kilograms, except for the bottom one. The first, we put 1,000 kilograms of nitrous oxide in the atmosphere. At steady state, in the steady state pattern, it formed 99.95%, that is 999.5 of the 1,000 kilograms, okay, went into the primary mode. So steady state and primary mode are almost identical. Not quite. The other one is I put 1,000 kilograms in the surface. It made 1,025 kilograms. Seemingly innocuous. That 1,025 then decayed with 110 years forever. Okay, for the 110 years. It seemed to make more than itself. Well, what happens is, if you think about it, it takes 2.5 years for the N2O to get through the atmosphere to where it's destroyed up in the stratosphere. That is 2.5 year delay. That's like 2.5% change before the loss builds up. And so actually, if you put it in the surface, you end up with effectively more than if you put it elsewhere. And if you put it at 40 kilometers where it's photolyzed like mad, that line three, you have only 22 out of 1,000 left in the primary mode. Most of it's destroyed by quick photochemistry in the stratosphere. That gives a very short steady state lifetime. Okay. Burden divided by flux. Okay. So there's a big difference on where you put the stuff as to what you get for a steady state lifetime. The last one is intriguing, by the way, is I just put, I assumed a solar proton event, lost 10 Dobson units of ozone above 28 kilometers. I took out 10 Dobson units of the whole column. And I found out what it did to N2O. And what it did was it basically took out 20 kilograms of nitrous oxide out of the atmosphere. So perturbations, even like solar proton events, are the equivalent of emissions or anti-emissions of nitrous oxide because they perturb the atmosphere. They actually kick it long enough. They actually change the effective emissions for that year. So it's important to realize that a lot of short-lived things are altering what we think of emissions of the long-lived gases. Okay. We've redone this in 3D. Just recently, we finished full 3D chemistry of this thing. We've done sort of stratospheric chemistry, linearized for nitrous oxide. We've added methane. Okay. This, you don't want to know about the linearization of the model. This is just showing that we're trying to match what the model's doing for the various species. And we end up with basically chemical budgets for what we put in. Oops. And this is the decay pattern, for example, by putting in methane. This is what happens to methane at 40 kilometers. You build it up, things decay. There are two decay times. One is the 10 years for methane. The other is the 100 years for N2O. You can see both patterns. This is at the upper stratosphere. We put a large amount of methane in the troposphere. It took a while to get up there. This is methane going up and decaying. It affects ozone. This is nitrous oxide. What we found out, which we're after, was if we put in methane in the atmosphere, we actually produce nitrous oxide. This is new. You should expect it, but the question is, what's it doing? Methane changes the stratospheric ozone. Okay, stratospheric ozone controls the nitrous oxide loss. Unfortunately, it was very disappointing. The magnitude of that, you see that log scale? I would have liked to see the N2O curve a little higher, then it would have been big news, and not just a GRL paper. But this is the budget ones. So the net effect is, do I have the one here? Sorry. Net effect is pretty small. If you put in a huge amount of methane, you end up with about 0.1% or 0.1% of nitrous oxide left. So it's a large amount, pardon me, it's an interesting coupling, but in terms of political or environmental issues, it's small. But literally, methane production gets to the stratosphere and effectively increases N2O. But unfortunately, it was a little small. So this is the number. Let's see, 100 teragrams of methane gives you a tenth of a teragram of nitrous oxide. It's not enough to get too excited about. It was sort of interesting. If it had been 1 teragram, that would have been very large, because nitrous oxide is 10 times the lifetime. It's long-lived. It's a really big greenhouse gas. It would have been quite something. But alas, it wasn't. So another failed one. There's a range of papers. You can see this one. You get a copy of this from Dylan, okay, on this one. But finally, I want to leave you with, you know, what is it that we can do or not do? So this is from Embry and Trefethen, guys who work on spectra and pseudospectra, behavior of non-normal matrices. So I love this. So they point out how eigenvalues have their use, and we've often used them in many systems like this one in atmospheric chemistry. It's not new. It's 19th century science, okay? And the one on the left I like is it's the harmonics of a bell. So it's the, was it the harmonics of a, let's see, it's a minor third, Carillon bell. And so the frequency is this way, and the decay time is this way. So it's actually the amplitude and the eigenvalues, effectively the modes of the decay mode. So you have all the different modes that are preferred, the different frequencies, the bell's tune. And then you see the ones on the left that are closer to more negative decay more quickly, and you're left with the dominant modes, and finally with the humming mode. So it's very nice. It's sort of an eigenvalue decomposition of a Carillon bell, which is better than the chemistry. So I sort of like that one as a nice example. But then you get on to the fact that, you know, what really we get out of it. The eigenvalues are great because they give you diagonalization and separation of variables. We can see we can decompose things into modes. We can get the modes that you can separate the variables. It's very nice. And then you find out what the real variables are, which are these patterns. The real variable in the atmosphere is not methane. It's methane plus CO plus OH plus whatever at a given pattern. That's sort of the core variable by the eigenvalues. Resonance. You sort of understand a heightened response. We don't see that in chemistry. It's sort of like, can you poke at something at the resonant frequency? You don't get that one. The other one is asymptotics and stability. That's important. We're looking at chemistry for asymptotics and stability. That is an issue of, you know, what do you excite? Is it stable or not? And sort of what's the K term? And finally, I love it. There are other examples. They give a matrix of personality, which I thought was great. But then they go on to say, you know, the remaining 90% of the book, plus book, is spent on non-normal matrices, and that's when this whole thing fails. And so this issue is that if this is the eigenvector matrix, this is the matrix of the vectors, if you do V, V inverse, and you take the norms, if that number becomes much, much greater than 1, you have like the equivalent ill-determined matrix, but it's an ill-determined matrix system. And that's what they go in and then decide pseudospectra and non-normal matrices. So the question is, does this really come into play yet in the atmosphere? And I haven't seen it yet in atmospheric chemistry. But the question is, what happens? Will this happen or not? Does it happen if we think about climate change and variable, you know, dynamical systems combining with it? So they have plenty of examples where the eigenvalue system falls apart and no longer is a good predictor. But we haven't yet seen it in chemistry. So better quit on that one. Thank you very much for your attention.